Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today is our third episode on Enoch Powell, and of course I will be joined by Max Musson from Western Spring. Okay, we'll begin with a summary. We talked about how Powell did not just speak out against immigration in his famous Rivers of Blood speech, but also the Race Relations Act, and how it did away with the centuries-old right to freedom of association. After this speech, he was dropped by the Conservative Party, but remained loyal to them, and failed to form his own party, despite having at least three-quarters of the country supporting him. Immigration was soon to take a back seat, though, as Ted Heath took Britain into the European Economic Community without a mandate, and Powell switched his backing to Labour at the next election in the hopes that they would take us out again. The result this time was a hung Parliament, but with Labour winning the most seats. The public knew that it was Powell who had swung the election, and he was finally able to get his revenge on the man who had sold British sovereignty to the EU. And unfortunately, Labour didn't then take us out of the EU. You were saying last week they had a referendum and we lost. Is that correct, Max?
Yes, in 1975, there was the first referendum for membership of the European Economic Community, I think, in those days. And the same Project Fear was entered into by the news media and by large corporations in this country, where they tried to make everybody feel that if we didn't stay within the European Economic Community, that we would lose millions of jobs, that there would be massive unemployment, that the country would be beggared, etc. And so the result of that campaign was that we stayed in. But you know, I always felt that there were inconsistencies which made the election result absurd, which, you know, one of which was apparently a majority of people in Northern Ireland voted for us to stay within the European Economic Community, when at that particular point in time the troubles in Northern Ireland were at such a point that I couldn't see how the unionist community would have voted to stay within an international structuring of countries where effectively the unionists and the republicans would be effectively power sharing in the same state. So it was my belief at that point in time that wouldn't have naturally happened, but you know, perhaps I was wrong, because the Northern Ireland agreement that's been signed since then would tend to suggest that there is a majority of people in Northern Ireland who want the troubles to be behind them and are prepared to live within the constraints that are necessary in order to enable the peaceful situation that currently exists in Northern Ireland to persist.
And of course, that's exactly the sticking point that there was with the Brexit referendum, wasn't it? They were arguing about the backstop in Northern Ireland for about 4 years, weren't they? And then finally, it was the EU that actually put the backstop in place, even though it only lasted for 24 hours. Well, in the sudden general election of October 1974, Powell returned to Parliament as the Ulster Unionist MP for South Down, having rejected an offer to stand as candidate for the National Front, formed 7 years earlier and fiercely opposed to non-white immigration. He also repeated his call to vote Labour because of their policy on the EEC. Since 1968, Powell had been an increasingly frequent visitor to Northern Ireland, and in keeping with his general British nationalist viewpoint, he sided strongly with the Ulster Unionists in their desire to remain a constituent part of the United Kingdom. From early 1971, he opposed with increasing vehemence Heath's approach to Northern Ireland, with the greatest breach between them coming over the imposition of direct rule in 1972. He strongly believed that direct rule would only survive if the Unionists strove to integrate completely with the United Kingdom by abandoning devolved rule in Northern Ireland. He refused to join the Orange Order, and was the first Ulster Unionist MP at Westminster never to be a member, and he was an outspoken opponent of the more extremist loyalism espoused by Ian Paisley and his supporters. Now, the troubles in Northern Ireland are not really something I know that much about. I have been impressed with the party that joined up with the Conservatives in the power sharing with the Conservatives, and I forget the name of the lady that leads it, but I was quite actually impressed with them and the way that she spoke out against abortion. And it does seem to me that Northern Ireland is probably the most traditionalist minded out of all the governments that we have in the United Kingdom. And, you know, I've seen this Ian Paisley's son. I think he's pretty good as well. I think he's a reverend. And this Orange Order as well. I don't know much about them. I think they supported Cromwell. Maybe I'm wrong in that. Max, what do you know about Northern Ireland and this situation back in the 70s?
Well, the situation back in the 70s was that there was a sharp division between the two communities, that the Ulster Unionists obviously wanted Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom, and the Republican parties, which consisted of Sinn Féin and the Democratic Unionist Party, there was another more moderate party, I can't remember the name of them off the top of my head, who were representing the Republicans, and they wanted effectively a United Ireland, but there was a lot of violence, and this is why I, at the time, I felt that it was unlikely that the majority of people in Northern Ireland would have voted for the UK to remain part of the European Economic Community, and for the south of Ireland, for ERA to be part of the European Economic Community as well, because it effectively then meant that Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland were effectively in the same nation state. Now, as we can see, that the resistance to Britain being totally absorbed into a new nation state in Europe has prevented that outcome, but at the time it was a very real threat, and during our period within the European Union there were a number of efforts that were made in order to break the United Kingdom up into small pieces that would then individually be so small that they couldn't survive as a nation state on their own. And so there was the encouragement of Scottish nationalism, the encouragement of Welsh nationalism, and also the encouragement of regionalism in the UK, with the hope that with the hope that England would break up into the nine constituent parts that the nine regions that the European Union had marked out for us, and as I say, none of those ninths of England could have existed as a separate nation state in its own right, realistically. So it was just a period of very heightened tension, a period of violence where there were frequent riots and where there were frequent murders of people on either side. I think that the eventual Good Friday Agreement that was agreed was very much a fudge of the entire issue, where effectively the British government's finally admitted that they didn't have the stomach for the fight, and that they were therefore going to accommodate the wishes of the IRA, and where I think intense pressure was probably put on the loyalist paramilitaries to accept the agreement as well, which they appear to have reluctantly done. There was a process during which there was a distinguished chap from Canada who came over to Britain to oversee the destruction of the weapons that the paramilitary groups had. How thoroughly that was done, I don't know, but I suspect that the paramilitaries on both sides have still got caches of arms, and that this is one of the reasons why the government reacted so strongly to the European Union recently wishing to establish a hard border for, from the point of view of the import and export of COVID-19 vaccines, because it would, by establishing that hard border, that would have been a breach of the Good Friday Agreement and could then theoretically have set the different paramilitary groups at each other's throats again.
They've changed the name as well. I mean, back then it was Ulster, wasn't it? And you don't really hear of Ulster now. They talk about Northern Ireland, and this was the Ulster Unionists. And I'm guessing that the Ulster Unionists became the Democratic Unionist Party, which is actually headed by Arlene Foster. That's the name of the lady I couldn't remember before. Well, in the aftermath of the Birmingham pub bombings by the Provisional Irish Republican Army on the 21st of November 1974, the government passed the Prevention of Terrorism Act. During its second reading, Powell warned of passing legislation in haste and under the immediate pressure of indignation on matters which touch the fundamental liberties of the subject. For both haste and anger are ill counsellors, especially when one is legislating for the rights of the subject. I'm really pleased to see that he was speaking up about that. I mean, who would have thought back then that that would have ended up needing to be used against Islamic terrorists, and that they would have gone after nationalist groups with this legislation, ending up with today with 13 and 14 year old children being charged under it. Powell said terrorism was a form of warfare that could not be prevented by laws and punishments, but only by the aggressor's certainty that the war was impossible to win. In his later career as an Ulster Unionist MP, he continued to criticise the United States and claimed that the Americans were trying to persuade the British to surrender Northern Ireland into an all-Irish state because the condition for Irish membership of NATO, Powell claimed, was Northern Ireland. The Americans wanted to close the yawning gap in NATO defence that was from the southern Irish coast to northern Spain. He had a copy of a State Department policy statement from the 15th of August 1950, in which the American government said that the agitation caused by partition in Ireland lessens the usefulness of Ireland in international organisations and complicates strategic planning for Europe. It is desirable, the document continued, that Ireland should be integrated into the defence planning of the North Atlantic area for its strategic position. And present lack of defensive capacity are matters of significance. Now, I find this interesting because I always thought that American support for Southern Ireland was because they romanticised their Irish heritage. But according to this, there was actually a strategic basis for this, that they wanted to make better use of Ireland in NATO. Were you aware of that before, Max?
No, I'd say that's news to me, to be quite honest. I think that the there was quite obviously during that period touting for votes by American politicians of Irish extraction, and that touting for votes was in the form of them making promises to the Republican political parties, both in Ireland and also in Southern Ireland and Northern Ireland. And so, you know, and we now have the situation where we have Biden talking about what apparently, according to news reports, not being sympathetic to Britain because of his Irish ancestry and the fact that he continues to hold a grievance against England or the United Kingdom as a result of that. And so I think that it's the romantic or overly romanticized Irish connection that was the issue, and not NATO strategies. I can't see that Ireland plays much of a part. It's not a frontline state as far as NATO is concerned. You know, it's not got a border with the Soviet. It didn't have a border with what was the Soviet Union in those days. It didn't have a border with the communist pact countries that composed Eastern Europe at the time. So therefore, what more could the island of Ireland do than provide NATO bases for shipping and things of that sort, of aircraft to land en route from the United States to Britain, or from Britain en route to other Western European countries. There was no further development that could have been entered into that would have made Ireland more significant as a result of Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland being united.
It's interesting that he's really sort of throwing himself into being part of the Ulster Unionists. He was originally from, I think he was in Birmingham, wasn't he, and Sheffield, and now he's there in Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland does seem to be the most patriotic part of the country, I would suggest. It's the only part of the country that really has those marching bands still, although they do pledge support for Cromwell. And obviously, I am against Cromwell and what he did in Ireland. I see him pretty much as being one of the first Bolsheviks with his revolution that he had there, the Puritan Revolution. But they are very patriotic in Northern Ireland.
What I would say is that the Unionist community would be patriotic as far as the UK is concerned. I think as far as the Republican communities are concerned, their patriotism would extend down towards Southern Ireland. And so, I can remember visiting Northern Ireland on quite a few occasions. If you went into the Unionist or the Loyalist areas, then there were certain places where you would find that every alternate curbstone down the street would be painted red, white or blue. And there would be huge murals painted on the sides of buildings, lionizing various members of the Unionist paramilitaries and being used as recruiting posters for the Unionist paramilitaries and declaring that this part of Ireland was forever British. And in the same way, there were places in Northern Ireland where there was quite obviously a war being fought. I mean, I can remember being driven in a taxi through parts of Belfast and along the Falls Road where during that time probably every fourth or fifth building was completely burnt out, and this was because of the ongoing terrorism directed by the Republican terrorists in order to try and drive the UK government, the British as they called us, out of Northern Ireland. And so this was a so in terms of patriotism, I think the Irish are a very patriotic people, and I think that the Ulster Unionists, their patriotism is towards the UK, whereas the Republicans, it would be towards the United Ireland, united with the South.
That's a really good point to make. It shows the ethnicity there, doesn't it? It's not an ethnic difference between the Northern Irish and the Southern Irish. It's just a religious difference and a patriotic loyalty difference. Well, although he voted with the Conservatives in a vote of confidence that brought the Labour government down on the 28th of March, Powell did not welcome the victory of Margaret Thatcher in the May 1979 election. Grim was Powell's response when asked what he thought of Thatcher's victory, because he believed she would renege, just like Heath did in 1972. I guess that's on the EEC. During the election campaign, Thatcher, when questioned, again repeated her vow that there would be no position for Powell in her cabinet if the Conservatives won the forthcoming general election. In the days after the election, Powell wrote to Callaghan to commiserate on his defeat, paying tribute to his reign and wishing him well. Now, I think this was an important election because the National Front were doing exceptionally well, and I believe that Margaret Thatcher gave the impression that the Conservatives were going to do something about immigration. And that's why people switched their votes from the National Front to the Conservatives. And then when the Conservatives got in, they did nothing about immigration. Exactly the same thing that David Cameron did when he said he was going to get immigration down to the 10,000 a year. And then they changed it to tens of thousands. And then they quietly gave up on that. But this was started at this point, I believe, with Margaret Thatcher. She capitalised on the anti-immigration sentiment in the country, gave the impression that she was going to put a stop to it, and that's why she was voted in. Am I correct in thinking that, Max? Was that this election?
I believe so, yes, from memory. I think that as far as Margaret Thatcher is concerned, she made a very famous speech where she referred to it being quite legitimate for the British people to fear that they were being swamped by immigration, and it was that speech which caused a lot of people who had previously been supporting the National Front to switch over to the Conservatives, only again to be betrayed by Margaret Thatcher. And it's a recurring thing that every Conservative government has pledged to control or reduce immigration. That used to be that they were pledging to reduce immigration. Now they just pledge to control it. They don't say which way they're going to control it, up or down, but they talk about controlling it. And yet every step along the way, the Conservatives have done the complete opposite. They've not controlled immigration, and they have, if anything, increased it massively in recent years, just as the last Labour government did.
And the National Front have never regained the popularity that they actually had before this election as well. I think they stood a candidate in every seat throughout the country. They were absolutely huge at this time. And I can remember Richard Edmonds talking about how they were really sort of stabbed in the back by the Conservatives, because the Conservatives just capitalised on all this support that was there for the National Front and stole that support away from them. And unfortunately, the National Front never regained that support. And also around this time, we started seeing more race riots. After a race riot in Bristol in 1980, Powell asserted that the media were ignoring similar events in South London and in Birmingham, claiming far less than the foreseeable new Commonwealth and Pakistan ethnic proportion would be sufficient to constitute a dominant political force in the United Kingdom, able to extract from a government and the main party's terms calculated to render its influence still more impregnable. Far less than this proportion would provide the bases and citadels for urban terrorism, which would in turn reinforce the overt political leverage of simple numbers. He attacked the false nostrums and promises of those who apparently monopolise the channels of communication. Who then is likely to listen, let alone to respond, to the proof that nothing short of major movements of population can shift the lines along which we are being carried towards disaster? So there's 3 points there that he's bringing up. He's saying the actual numbers of the newcomers are now sufficient for them to become a dominant political force. And of course, that's what we've seen throughout the country, particularly in London with Sadiq Khan, who is now the incompetent acting mayor of London. He's only there because of the numbers of non-whites there. Another point here, he talks about bases and citadels for urban terrorism. We have 1,000 stabbings a week now in Britain, I noticed the other day. That's not 1,000 people killed, but 1,000 knife crimes every week, 50,000 knife crimes in a year. We do actually have Islamic terrorism. We've had bombs go off. So we do now have bases and citadels being used for urban terrorism. And the third point, he's talking about the people that monopolize the channels of communication, the false nostrums and promises of those who apparently monopolize the channels of communication. So we've got the fake news media there that are covering up for all of this. And the main point he's bringing up is that the media are ignoring these race riots. They're not just happening in Bristol. They've been happening in South London. They've been happening in Birmingham. And the mass media is covering it up and pretending that it isn't happening. And there were quite a lot of these race riots that went on in the 80s, I think. You must remember some of these going on, Max.
Yeah, there were race riots that were going on. I think that one of the things looking back is that the process of multiculturalizing Britain has been far more insidious than perhaps than violent. That we have had the odd pieces of Islamic terrorism that have occurred, but by and large, what's happened is that the very fact that successive governments have continually promised to reduce, then control immigration, the fact that the British people have been confronted with race relations legislation which is aimed at curtailing freedom of speech and from criminalising people based upon their views, and based upon their views, i.e. views that are opposed to immigration, and the fact that the amount of force used in this respect has been kind of overwhelming, has tended to mean that, firstly, the immigrant populations haven't felt the need to be as violent as I think Enoch Powell thought that they might turn out to be, and basically because everything's going their way anyway, from the point of view of the way in which our society is developing, and from the point of view of the British people themselves, our people have to some extent been wrong-footed and left despondent and forlorn, really, by the fact that so many governments now in succession have deserted the interests of the British people. And I think it's come as a shock, a very profound psychological shock to the majority of people of this country, that when they have actually finally come to realise that the established political parties actually don't care a fig about them, that the established political parties are prepared to lie and lie and lie and cheat in order to stay in power and in order to stop the British people from being able to act in our own ethnic interests.
Yeah, you seem to be talking there about them having enough numbers to take over violently. And of course, they didn't need to do that. Tony Blair created the position of Lord Mayor of these multicultural cities that became majority non-white. So they were just able to vote in non-white leaders. And I'm just wondering, it was this Bristol race riot that took place in the 80s, is that the one when PC Keith Blakelock was beheaded? There was a white police officer that was actually beheaded at one of these race riots. So you would have thought that they would have brought in laws to prevent the race riots, not brought in laws to prevent people from talking about it. Do you remember this incident with PC Keith Blakelock?
It was an estate in London. I think it was one of the kind of southern parts of London. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. PC Blakelock, though, and something farm. It was the name of the estate.
Croydon.
Well, I don't think it was Croydon, but there was an estate which had farm in the title. As I say, I can't remember off the top of my head exactly what the name of the place was. But yes, there was a riot there in London, and as Enoch Powell said, the riots in London weren't being properly reported. But PC Blakelock was in pursuit of people who were seen to have been throwing petrol bombs, and he became separated from the rest of the group of police that he was with, and was surrounded by a group, a rioting immigrant group, who then stabbed him many times and cut his head off, and that caused a tremendous shock. But again, you see, the media in this country then went into overdrive in playing down, sort of initially acknowledging the shock, but then playing down the implications of that particular thing. And the chap who was initially convicted of being the main malfeasant, who was accused of actually sort of killing PC Blakelock, he eventually, I believe, was released from prison some sort of 20 or so years later, perhaps 30 years later, on the basis that it was the evidence was unsound, and so PC Blakelock's murder has gone unpunished, and he's not been given the justice that he deserves.
Yeah, and I've only heard this mentioned in nationalist publications about this PC Keith Blakelock, but at the moment BBC Radio 4 are doing a series on fascism in Britain, and of course they're talking about the Battle of Lewisham and the left and the big attack that went on there, and the attack on Oswald Mosley's fascists. And we don't hear anything about the long list of race riots that actually took place, and crimes like a police officer being beheaded. You would think that the first time somebody was beheaded in Britain was drummer Lee Rigby, but no, it wasn't. It was a white police officer by these immigrants in London in the early 80s, and these race riots were a regular occurrence back then. And
yes, it was Broadwater Farm. That was the name of the estate where PC Blakelock was killed. And you're quite right. You know, the members of the public today might be forgiven for thinking that the murder of Lee Rigby was the first time anybody in this country had their head chopped off in the streets. in sort of inter-ethnic violence, but that's not the case. That PC Blakelock was beheaded in the same way all those years ago, and just as though with PC Blakelock, the Lee Rigby murder has it's not gone unavenged, in the sense that the two people responsible have been sent to prison, but the two people responsible like continue to campaign for their release. And I can imagine that in perhaps another 10 or 15 years, that the case will be reviewed, and that because people are so much older and their memories would have dimmed, etc., that the people that killed Lee Rigby may well be released from prison on the basis that the evidence against them is unsound for some technical reason, and that Lee Rigby will also go unavenged.
I think one of the killers of Lee Rigby, he spoke at a Unite Against Fascism rally. We don't see the UAF being banned or Hope Not Hate because of that. We'll begin with a recap of what we discussed last week. Enoch Powell joined the Ulster Unionists, and we talked about how patriotic the Irish are and how rigid the sectarian lines over there were in the 70s. He spoke out against the Prevention of Terrorism Act for encroaching on the fundamental liberties of the British people, and he remained concerned about America, not seeing them as our greatest ally, but as a competitor. We talked a bit about the election of Margaret Thatcher and how she won by taking the nationalist vote, promising to deal with immigration and then ignoring the issue once she was elected. Finally, we brought up the race riots that were starting to happen and how Powell accused the press of covering them up. And Max pointed out that Powell was anticipating a violent takeover when this was actually carried out through the ballot box and through speech laws that shielded the new communities from scrutiny. Do you want to add anything to that recap, Max?
No, I think that's a fairly thorough recap. Yes, let's press on.
Okay, in the 1980s, Powell began promoting unilateral nuclear disarmament. In a debate on the nuclear deterrent on the 3rd of March 1981, he claimed that the debate was now more political than military, that the UK did not possess an independent deterrent, and that through NATO, the UK was tied to the nuclear deterrence theory of the United States. In the debate on the address, shortly after the general election of 1983, Powell picked up on Thatcher's willingness, when asked, to use nuclear weapons as a last resort. Powell presented a scenario of what he thought the last resort would be, namely that the Soviet Union would be ready to invade the UK and had used a nuclear weapon somewhere such as Rockall to demonstrate their willingness to use it. And he said, "What would the United Kingdom do? Would it discharge Polaris, Trident or whatever against the main centres of population on the continent of Europe or in European Russia? If so, what would be the consequence? The consequence would not be that we should survive, that we should repel our antagonist, nor would it be that we should escape defeat. The consequence would be that we would make certain, as far as is humanly possible, the virtual destruction and elimination of the hope of the future in these islands. I would much sooner that the power to use it was not in the hands of any individual in this country at all." And Powell went on to say that if the Soviet invasion had already begun and the UK resorted to a retaliatory strike, the results would be the same. "We should be condemning not merely to death, but as near as may be the non-existence of our population," he said. To Powell, an invasion would take place with or without the UK's nuclear weapons, and therefore there was no point in retaining them. He said that after years of consideration, he had come to the conclusion that there were no rational grounds on which the deformation of our defence preparations in the United Kingdom by our determination to maintain a current independent nuclear deterrent can be justified. Now, I was really surprised to hear this, that he was against nuclear arms, because really that puts him in the camp of the CND, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And they were massive in the 80s. And I can't really see Enoch Powell speaking at one of these CND rallies that went on there. Was he well known for being against nuclear disarmament? Max, what are your thoughts on this?
He was quite well known. I don't know that he would have gone to Greenham Common and spoken to the Greenham Common women or anything of that sort, but or that he would have necessarily gone to any. I don't recall seeing him or hearing of him speaking at any CND rallies. But yes, I do remember him speaking out and writing about this issue. And I think really he was quicker than most people to just realise that what we were looking at with nuclear war would be mutually assured destruction. Where I would take issue with him, though, is that once nuclear weapons exist, then it would be necessary to have nuclear weapons in order to deter somebody else from using nuclear weapons against you, because nuclear weapons are a weapon that you can only really use against a nation that doesn't have nuclear weapons to actually fire back because of mutually assured destruction. So as far as the once both the Americans and the Russians or the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons, then there was never any real prospect that the Russians would go to war with the Soviet Union, rather, would go to war with the United States of America, because it would be mutually assured destruction. There was always the possibility that either one of those two superpowers could go to war with another country and could resort to using nuclear weapons quite sparingly. It would only need to be used, I would imagine, but using nuclear weapons sparingly against that that other power, because they would have no way of hitting back, and that's why the only example of a nuclear weapon being used in anger was the Americans dropping the two nuclear bombs on Japan, and no nuclear weapons have ever been used since, and that's just simply because anybody with any brains realizes that if you use a nuclear weapon against another country that's got nuclear weapons, then you're just effectively committing suicide.
Yeah, that mutually assured destruction, I mean, that has supposedly really kept the peace. That's what they say since the end of the Second World War. It's because we have these nuclear weapons, we have such a huge stockpile that nobody would actually dare invading another country. But of course, there's been loads of wars that have gone on since that time, carried out mainly by America, nowadays through proxies in Syria, and they're trying to start a war at the moment with China, and they're always going on at North Korea. We've got all these little troubles that seem to flare up around the world, but apparently because we have this nuclear deterrent, then you're not going to get well, at the time you wouldn't have got the Soviet Union invading America, or you wouldn't have had America invading the Soviet Union. But a lot of people were really against this. You brought up the Greenham Common there, Max, the Greenham Common ladies, and I remember seeing them on the news, and I think they were just on Greenham Common 365 days a year. I think they had a camp there or something, and they were chaining themselves to the fences, and they were determined to get rid of nuclear weapons. What was going on there at Greenham Common, do you know?
Well, precisely what you've just been saying, actually, that these were women who, and they were women because it was at the start of the sort of big push for feminism in this country. And so these women got together and they went and camped around the American nuclear bases and the air bases, and they just basically maintained a permanent 24/7, 365 day of the year protest against the presence of those camps here in the UK. They kind of became a bit of a laughing stock because very large numbers of them tended to be very butch, and they tended to dress very eccentrically, and so they often were the butt of jokes and that sort of thing. But you know, they had a point, albeit the point they were making was wrong, because for us to have divested ourselves of nuclear weapons would have then meant that Britain could have become a victim of a nuclear power, and the only way that we can stop ourselves from becoming the victim of a nuclear power is by having a nuclear weapon of our own, even though we would never want to use that nuclear weapon ourselves, we have to have it whilst nuclear weapons exist in order to deter other powers from taking advantage of us. And so the Green and Common women were wrong. And as far as Enoch Powell was concerned, he was wrong in saying that he didn't want there to be any nuclear weapons in this country. We had to have nuclear weapons. We didn't necessarily have to have a lot of them, just enough to cause such damage to any country that attacks us that it would deter them from any desire to attack Britain or to take advantage of us. It hasn't stopped wars altogether, as you quite rightly pointed out. There have been these proxy wars, and what's happened instead is that the nuclear powers of the world have, including Britain, have fought wars around the world through the use of proxy nations, where they can work to extend their influence without actually going head to head with another nuclear power.
You brought up the feminist aspect there, Max. Was it actually seen at the time as if it was a male thing to support nuclear weapons and it was a female thing to be against them?
I suppose that would have been the line of thinking that lots of the feminists would have had. Feminism has always portrayed anything that they see as negative within society as being the fruit of the masculine mind. And so therefore, in that these women were opposed to us having a nuclear deterrent and opposed to the existence of nuclear weapons, they would regard nuclear weapons as being an invention of the male mind and something that men would want but women wouldn't want. I mean, that's wrong, of course, because it's lots of women politicians and women leaders have supported our possession of nuclear weapons for the logical reasons that I've just set forward. But logic has never been a strong suit of the left wing mind, and so it that didn't dawn on the Green and Common women.
Well, of course, the men have to have some way to defend the women. I guess they saw the missiles as phallic as well, so probably against them because of that. Well, after that, Powell returned to being anti-immigration. On the 28th of March 1981, Powell gave a speech to Ashton-under-Lyne Young Conservatives, where he attacked the conspiracy of silence between the government and the opposition over the prospective growth through births of the immigrant population, saying, "We have seen nothing yet," is a phrase that we could with advantage repeat to ourselves whenever we try to form a picture of that future. He also criticised those who believed it was too late to do anything, and that there lies the certainty of violence on a scale which can only adequately be described as civil war. He also said that the solution was a reduction in prospective numbers, as would represent re-emigration, hardly less massive than the immigration which occurred in the first place. The Shadow Home Secretary, Labour MP Roy Hattersley, criticised Powell for using Munich beer hall language, despite there being a race riot in Brixton on the 11th of April, and when on the 13th of April an interviewer quoted to Thatcher Powell's remark that "we have seen nothing yet," she replied, "I heard him say that and I thought it was a very, very alarming remark. And I hope with all my heart that it isn't true." So we see here that the violence is increasing, and he's speaking out, and he's doing the right thing to speak out. If you see an upcoming hazard, it is your duty to warn people that there is a hazard coming ahead, and we need to do what we can to avoid this hazard. And he's pointing out that this hazard is being caused by the numbers of immigrants that are coming into the country that have different ways to us, that have much higher crime rates than us. Some people will say that it's five times as much crime actually is associated with some of these groups than actually with whites. All he was trying to do is prevent violence coming in the future. I mean, he describes it, he says it can only adequately be described as a civil war. And we look around now and we see the level of violence that we have, 50,000 stabbing attacks in a year, acid attacks, terrorism, grooming gangs, all these things that have been brought about by immigration. You can't blame the people themselves. It's the policy, it's the government policy of immigration which has brought all this violence about. And it was this immigration policy that he is criticising here, and he's advocating a new government policy of remigration, offering rewards to these people to go back to their homelands. And, you know, it's very sensible what he's saying here. And, of course, by referring to Munich beer hall language, they're effectively calling him Hitler, aren't they? Nothing's changed, has it?
No. And the fact, you know, I said last week that where Powell was wrong is that he expected much earlier that there would be much more serious interracial strife in this country than has taken place. And there have been these periodic spates of race riots that have taken place where immigrant communities have effectively used violence against the host community. But these have been limited in their extent and haven't developed to be anything like as severe as Enoch Powell predicted. And that's largely because of the cowardice of our governments in terms of realizing the threat that is mounting against the indigenous people of Britain. Well, what they have failed to see in their appeasement of the violence that was used in these various race riots, what they've failed to see is that demography is destiny. And what's happened is that instead of the immigrant communities multiplying at a greater rate of fecundity than the indigenous British people and then using violence and physical force to change our country, what's happened is that because our politicians have retreated and given so much and given influence to the immigrant communities and have changed the way our society is in order to try and placate the immigrant communities, what's happened is they've created a situation where the immigrant communities are still expanding at a much greater rate than the host population, the indigenous British. In fact, the indigenous British population is shrinking, and we've got the immigrant communities expanding. Firstly, because the immigration has continued at even greater rates than before, and because of the population growth within the immigrant communities, and so what we're facing is a situation where there will be a point later on in this century. Perhaps it's going to be 2060. It might be earlier than that. I've sort of estimated 2053 as being the date where, if current trends continue, that the indigenous British people will become a minority in our own land. And so the point is that there will be a takeover. There will be a tipping point reached around about the middle of this century where the conditions in this country, the civilization of this country, the laws of this country, etc., will be determined less and less by the indigenous British people and more by people who have come here, sometimes as willing migrants who've come here because they liked what they saw of the old Britain, and they liked the fact that, you know, we were a civilized country and that we had law and order, etc. But increasingly what's happened is that the immigrants come into this country have been young people who have left countries where we have used their nations as proxies in the kind of wars that we were just speaking about a few minutes ago, that have been a substitute for direct confrontations between superpowers. And so what we've got is a large number of immigrants in this country who are from Iraq, who are from Iran, who are from Syria, who are from Amman and Turkey and places of that sort, where there have been wars and where their homes and their hometowns have been destroyed because of the proxy wars that we've been involved in. And they've come to Britain to better themselves, as they always say, but they've come to Britain with a certain amount of dislike of the British people, because you couldn't have your hometown destroyed and then go and live in the country of the people who caused your hometown to be destroyed without being resentful against the people who destroyed your hometown. And so the point is that there will increasingly be an immigrant population in this country which is resentful of Britain and what Britain was in the past, and that is resentful of the kind of proxy wars that we've become engaged in, and who will look back at their homelands and they'll see the shattered streets of Damascus, the shattered streets of Kabul and places of this sort, and they will blame us for what happened to their homelands. And so the sort of thing that Powell foresaw is not coming quickly in the sense that they would follow after his speech. They would rapidly follow after his speech race riots between the immigrant population and the indigenous British people, but there will be a reckoning that we will start to feel the heat from in the second part of this century.
It's only logical that there would be some animosity against the British, since the British were involved in encouraging these attacks in Syria and directly involved in Afghanistan. And that was something he wasn't actually having to deal with back then in the 80s. The people that were coming over from the Caribbean or coming over from the Congo or Kenya in Africa, and they weren't fleeing these war zones that had been destroyed by the very people that they were then moving into. And again, we have to point out, we're not blaming the people that move here for this. We are putting the blame squarely at the feet of the government for encouraging this and not listening to Enoch Powell and putting a stop to it. And we can also blame our mainstream media, who throughout Enoch Powell's life, they called him a racist and a hater and all the other buzzwords. Well, in July of 1981, a race riot took place in Toxteth, Liverpool, and Powell gave a speech in the Commons in which he said the riots could not be understood unless one takes into consideration the fact that in some large cities, between a quarter and a half of all those under 25 were either immigrant or descended from immigrants. He read out a letter he had received from a member of the public about immigration that included the line, "As they continue to multiply, and as we can't retreat further, there must be conflict." A Labour MP, Martin Flannery, responded by saying Powell was making a National Front speech. Powell predicted either inner London would become ungovernable, or we would see violence that could only effectively be described as civil war. Flannery intervened again to ask what Powell knew about inner cities. And I'll just stop there just to point out the amount of violence that we now have in London, I think, is what he was referring to there as the sort of violence that we would see in a civil war. And where he points out that parts of London would become ungovernable, we do have these ungovernable, lawless zones. We have them all the way across Europe, these areas that the police can't go into, the emergency services can't go in there at all, and that would fulfill this description here of ungovernable. Well, Powell replied to this. He said, "I was a member for Wolverhampton for a quarter of a century. What I saw in those early years of the development of this problem in Wolverhampton has made it impossible for me ever to dissociate myself from this gigantic and tragic problem." He also criticised the view that the causes of the riots were economic. "Are we seriously saying that so long as there is poverty, unemployment and deprivation, our cities will be torn to pieces? That the police in them will be the objects of attack and that we shall destroy our own environment? Of course not." Dame Judith Hart attacked his speech as an evil incitement to riot. Powell replied, "I am within the judgment of the House as I am within the judgment of the people of this country, and I am content to stand before either tribunal." After the Scarman report on the riots was published, Powell gave a speech on the 10th of December in the Commons. He disagreed with Scarman when he said the black community was alienated because it was economically disadvantaged, pointing out that the black community was alienated because it was alien. He said tensions would worsen because the non-white population was growing, whereas in Lambeth it was 25%, in those of secondary school age it was 40%. Powell said that the government should be honest with the people and tell them that in 30 years' time the black population of Lambeth will have doubled in size. In 1985, more race riots broke out between the black community and the police in London and in Birmingham, leading Powell to repeat his warning that ethnic civil conflict would be the ultimate outcome of foreign mass migration into the British Isles, and he reissued his call for a government-sponsored programme of repatriation. So we can see that everything that he predicted in the 60s is coming true. There is now more and more violence is occurring. Race riots are occurring. It's rapidly starting to get to the point where the white people in Lambeth are going to be a minority. I guess he's talking about London there. London must have been about 40% non-white at the time. And of course, now it's 60%. And white people actually are the minority in our capital city. I am impressed with the way he is speaking here in the House of Commons. I mean, he's been very forthright here. He's coming back with just the right answers to the people that are criticising him, to say that he doesn't know what he's talking about in inner cities when he's been in Wolverhampton for a quarter of a century. That's just ridiculous. And I think it's a good point that he makes that these riots are not economic. You know, you get lots of poor areas that have white people in them, and they don't riot and they don't have a massive crime rate. It's because of the rioting and the crime rate that businesses don't want to go in these areas, and that's why they have less money in them. If you have a look at America, you look at the poorest parts of America, they're in Appalachia. They're 99.9% white, and they also have the lowest crime rates in America. If you look at the areas that are majority black, places like Detroit, Chicago, Baltimore, they have massive crime rates, massive murder rates. So you really, you know, that's all you need to look at. And if you still think, well, those areas are multicultural, then all you have to do is look at Africa and look at South Africa in particular, in Johannesburg and places like that, to see that they are the most violent countries in the world. In fact, the top 10 countries in the world are all non-white countries. It's not because these people don't have any money that they commit these crimes. It's because they are far more likely to commit crimes that people don't want to invest there. They don't want to put the businesses there if they think the business is going to get burned down. And this is what we see happening with these Black Lives Matter riots in America this summer. $5 billion worth of damage was caused to businesses in those riots. So what we're talking now is 30 years after he was speaking here, and we're still suffering with these race riots. We're still suffering with the problems caused by multiculturalism. And Enoch Powell was a great hero to our people, I think, in speaking about this. The more we do this series, the more respect I have for this man, and I can see that he really rightfully is one of our greatest Britons. And Max, what are your thoughts on this increase in the race riots here?
Yeah, I think I would agree with everything you just said, actually. It's just such a great shame that, you know, here we are 30 years later and we're still having the same conversations. And although things haven't progressed quite as quickly as I think Powell predicted, we can see that things are moving in that direction. And the great sadness to me, really, is that rather than recognizing the danger that we've all been placed in by allowing continued migration allowing it to continue, what's happened is that the successive governments have tried to criminalize discussion of the consequences of continued mass immigration, you know, as if there was a multicultural society somewhere in the world which isn't torn by civil wars, that isn't torn by race riots, that isn't torn by very high levels of crime. You know, that they argue that that we mustn't be allowed to speculate as to what is the outcome, or to point out to what is the out to others what the outcome is of continued mass immigration into this country. And I remember during the period that National Action were banned, that the Home Secretary, I think it was at the time, pointed to the fact that members of National Action believed that there would be a race riot in this there would be a future race war in this country, and the fact that they believed that there would be a race war in this country was kind of put forward by the Home Secretary as if that in itself was justification for banning these people and locking them up. Now, you don't have to advocate a race war, and I don't advocate a race war. I don't want there to be a race war. I wouldn't go out of my way to provoke a race war or anything of that sort. But I can foresee that something of that sort could very well happen and probably will at some point in the future if we continue to allow mass immigration into this country, and particularly if we continue to allow mass immigration into this country from countries where those people are disgruntled with us because we've been involved in proxy wars that have destroyed their own homelands.
Well, I think that's what he's referring to here, isn't it? When he's talking about civil war, he's talking about civil war along racial lines, along sectarian lines. And it's not like this isn't something that's happened throughout our history. It is. It's been the cause of all the civil wars. It's always been territorial disputes between two different types of people. He's trying to prevent that here, and we're still trying to prevent it here today at Radio Albion. You know, that's why we're discussing this. We want to prevent this from happening. We don't want there to be a war between different peoples on British soil, and we think the best way to prevent that from happening is to have the peoples living separately. There's nothing hateful about that at all. It's all about wishing to avoid violence. It's all about wishing to avoid war and just wishing for the different peoples of the world to prosper, because we certainly aren't prospering all living together within one territory. It's just a recipe for conflict and strife, as we see time and time again. But thankfully, we do have these gifted, eloquent spokesman like Enoch Powell to raise this point, and he did have a lot of support, and I do believe we will have others that arrive in the future that are gifted and eloquent and can speak up for us, and I do have faith that something will eventually have to be done about this. We're not going to go into the, whatever the word is, the cold dark night quietly, at least. They may try to silence us, but that doesn't prevent these things from happening. As you pointed out, Max, these race riots were happening, and just to ban people from talking about them, that hasn't stopped the race riots, has it? They're still happening. They're happening in America this year. The last one to happen in Britain, I guess, was in Croydon. You could say that they have calmed down. We don't have so much of them now, but instead we just have a constant level of violence that is going on all the time. 50,000 stabbings last year. I think there's a murder every day. So there may not actually be a war on the streets, but there is this increased level of violence, and that's what we are seeking to avoid with the discussions that we have here at Radio Albion. Max, is there anything else you'd like to add to that, or shall we call it a day for today?
Well, just that in order to dull the senses and dull the wits of the indigenous British people, and to stop us thinking for ourselves, what we have nowadays as a result of mass immigration is this constant propaganda campaign that's being waged through the mass media, where we are being made to feel that we already are a multicultural society. In fact, not just a multicultural society, but a society in which non-white people are the majority. And I'm reminded of this constant campaign every time I turn on a television set, because what I see there are adverts now, and very often you can watch an entire advertising break on one of the commercial channels. You can watch an entire advertising break where not a single white person will feature in any of the adverts that are being shown. And so we're in a situation now where white people are being softened up and being made to feel that we actually don't really exist, and that we don't really have, because we don't really exist, we don't have any right to argue for our, in our own ethnic interests, that we have to just accept that other people have got an ethnic interest, but we don't, and that our place in this world is just to accept the changes that are taking place. And of course, that's not the case.
And of course, so that goes hand in hand with the rewriting of our history, sort of preparing us to be replaced. But the more they do it, the more people wake up to it and start organising and trying to advocate for our people, as Patriotic Alternative are doing. Thank you very much for listening, and do tune in again tomorrow for part 4 of our series on Enoch Powell.